Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the History on the Rocks podcast. This is your host, Cody, and we continue today our series on President John F. Kennedy leading up to his assassination. Now, we've talked in the last three episodes about his ideas, his values, his beliefs, his foreign policy, his economic policies, his domestic policies. We've talked about a lot of stuff. And as I told you in the introduction when we came back on air here, that this was going to be a juicy one. And it continues to become a juicy one the more and more I keep researching and the more fact-finding I do and just kind of my own analysis on the JFK assassination. Today, in part four, we're going to talk about two big events. We're going to talk about Berlin, and we're going to talk about a little bit about the Cuban Missile Crisis. I don't want to dive into the Cuban Missile Crisis so much, well, because it's pretty well known. And the Berlin situation is pretty well known as well, but there's just things with those two situations that kind of point us still in this direction of, is the assassination of John F. Kennedy, is there more to that story? And then finally today, the big topic is Kennedy's relationship with Israel, and also not just Israel, but Arab nations and the Middle East. So sit back, relax, grab your favorite drink, because we're about to dive into part four of our John F. Kennedy series.
In Berlin, as you recall, he intends to bring to an end, through a stroke of the pen, first, our legal rights to be in West Berlin, and secondly, our ability to make good on our commitments to 2 million people of that city.
In Kennedy's short presidency, before his assassination, he faced some of the most critical moments of his presidency that had the world on edge. The Cold War was hitting its breaking point, and the Soviet Union and the United States were at its wits' end with each other. The fear of a nuclear holocaust was sweeping throughout the world as tensions in Berlin and Cuba rose to extreme heights. If you're a fan of history, you know that after World War II, Europe was split into East and West, communism versus Western capitalist democracy. Many areas of the world have relics today showing this great divide, some even still existing, such as North and South Korea. But one of the greatest relic boundaries to exist during the Cold War, and still leaves its mark today, is the Berlin Wall. After the fall of Hitler and his Third Reich, the US, France, and Britain agreed to divide up Germany, as well as its capital, Berlin, with the Soviets. This led to a communist East Germany, and again, a democratic West Germany. This solution created more chaos than it did peace, the end result being the Berlin Wall that would divide Germans, family, and friends for 28 years until the wall came down in 1989. Kennedy wanted to protect West Berlin from Soviet takeover. This was because the whole of Berlin was in the eastern part of Germany and completely surrounded by the communist regime, a kind of enclave, if you will. The Soviets had the advantage of moving resources and troops around Berlin as they pleased. However, the only way in and out of West Berlin was one access road or by aircraft. Kennedy wanted to avoid war at all costs. As his brother Robert put it, quote, "The Soviets do not want a war, but pushed us to a brink. This was the closest we would get to nuclear war," end quote. Kennedy went to his military advisors, who suggested using nuclear weapons to instill fear in the Soviets. Kennedy walked out of the meetings both times it was suggested. He believed, quote, "Only a fool would claim victory in a nuclear conflict," end quote. Kennedy believed it was ridiculous to live in a world where the only options were, quote, "Holocaust or humiliation," end quote. JFK settled on a solution to add military presence in Berlin to show Soviet Premier Nikita Khrushchev that he didn't want conflict, but also that he would not appear weak and back down. Without any announcement, on August 13, 1961, the Soviets started to erect the Berlin Wall to deter East Germans from running to the free West Berlin, keeping them captive to the Soviet regime. Kennedy famously quoted, "A wall is a hell of a lot better than nuclear war." He also proclaimed to his friend William Walton, quote, "I am a peace at any price, President," end quote. As Kennedy was satisfied with a wall over a war, those below him in the U.S. military establishment did not agree with his methods. In fact, without Kennedy's knowledge, the United States military actually tried to knock down parts of the Berlin Wall. It seemed the military was taking actions into its own hands without presidential approval. This would increase tensions in Berlin, because as Kennedy stated, quote, "What right do we have to touch that wall? It is in East German territory," end quote. The military actually built duplicates of the wall in the German forests to practice destruction of the wall with mostly tanks. On October 27, 1961, the most intense standoff between U.S. tanks and Soviet tanks occurred at the center of the wall, known as Checkpoint Charlie. This standoff lasted for 16 hours before Kennedy called irate to the general on the ground, ordering him to, quote, "get those tanks out of there," end quote.
When that day finally comes, as it will, the people of West Berlin can take sober satisfaction in the fact that they were in the front lines for almost two decades. All free men, wherever they may live, are citizens of Berlin. And therefore, as a free man, I take pride in the words, "Ich bin ein Berliner."
Now, even though the intensity of the Berlin crisis had the world holding their breath, it was nothing compared to the most critical moment in world history, where nuclear war seemed almost unstoppable. The Cuban Missile Crisis put the world into a complete panic, as the second hand on the nuclear clock almost struck midnight.
Or if Cuba should ever attempt to export its aggressive purposes by force or the threat of force against any nation in this hemisphere, or become an offensive military base of significant capacity for the Soviet Union, then this country will do whatever must be done to protect its own security and that of its allies.
Now, back in October of 1962, the world faced its most tense moment for 2 weeks as the U.S. and Soviet Union were at the brink of a nuclear conflict. The Cuban Missile Crisis is one of the most talked about events during the Cold War, so I don't want to spend as much time on the topic. However, there are some things that are important about Kennedy's largest task during his presidency that annoyed people in power, unelected power. In short, Soviet Premier Khrushchev, he was planning to put nuclear missiles in Cuba, an obvious offensive threat to the United States.
Within the past week, unmistakable evidence has established the fact that a series of offensive missile sites is now in preparation on that imprisoned island. The purpose of these bases can be none other than to provide a nuclear strike capability against the Western Hemisphere.
With Cuba only being about 90 miles off the coast of the U.S., the Soviets could hit any city at any moment without the chance for the United States to respond. Roughly 80 million people could be killed. That's almost half of the U.S. population at the time. On the flip side, the Soviets knew without missiles close to the U.S., they would not be able to respond to a U.S. first strike. In July of 1962, the first round of missiles were being delivered to Cuba, something that the American government needed to respond to quickly. JFK was put in a tight spot. He knew that any military response in Cuba would be met with a Soviet counterattack. The military insisted that it was doubtful the Soviets would retaliate, but JFK did not want to take that chance. Curtis LeMay, U.S. Air Force general, argued for a direct airstrike on Cuba immediately and claimed the Soviets would not respond to such an attack. During their meeting, LeMay claimed that not doing anything would make JFK look weak and that it would be viewed just as bad as the appeasement of Hitler when Britain gave them Czechoslovakia to avoid World War II, which eventually happened anyway. Kennedy could not believe how direct LeMay was being about the president's situation. Kennedy later said to his White House aide, Kenny O'Donnell, quote, "The only advantage in their favor of doing what the military wants would be that none of us would be alive to tell them that they were wrong," end quote. The military establishment was extremely annoyed with Kennedy's gradual approach to the situation. They wanted quick and direct action. Over at the Pentagon, there was hate and rage flowing through the halls, almost a coup-like atmosphere. In the end, Kennedy and Khrushchev were able to handle things diplomatically and end the conflict without any war breaking out.
Namely, that the Soviet missile bases in Cuba are being dismantled, their missiles and related equipment are being crated, and the fixed installations at these sites are being destroyed.
The U.S. didn't want a nuclear war, and neither did the Soviets. I highlighted this incident to show the anger pointed at JFK for his decisions by the hostile military establishment. Just more proof that people on the inside in unelected positions didn't agree with the way he ran his administration. In a direct quote from General Curtis LeMay, he stated, quote, "We lost. We ought to just go in there today and knock them off. We had a chance to throw the communists out of Cuba. But this administration was scared to death that the Russians might shoot at us," end quote. Kennedy wanted to work on the disarmament of nuclear weapons. He had always been agitated when they were brought up in conversation. In a meeting with Governor Nelson Rockefeller, JFK's national security advisor recounted that after Rockefeller had suggested just nuking the Soviets, the president's hand began to shake just at the suggestion. He calmly responded, quote, "You know we aren't going to do that," end quote. JFK believed the use of a single nuclear weapon would be the nation's ultimate failure.
In its first two decades, the age of nuclear energy has been full of fear, yet never empty of hope. Today, the fear is a little less and the hope a little greater. For the first time, we've been able to reach an agreement which can limit the dangers of this age. The agreement itself is limited, but its message of hope has been heard and understood not only by the peoples of the three originating nations, but by the peoples and governments of the 100 other countries that have signed.
Many in the American government and the public did not like that Kennedy called for peace with the Soviet Union and humanized communists. Many thought this was a weak approach to dealing with such a threat to the world. In fact, the military was so angered with JFK that they did not support any joint space missions JFK wanted because they were uneasy about sharing rocket technologies. JFK continued to try and monitor and inspect our adversaries' nuclear weapon testing, but Khrushchev would have none of it. It was the main reason the Soviets and the U.S. could not come to a nuclear deal. JFK even tried to make peace with the Soviets by sending wheat to help with the food shortages in the Soviet Union, a move he deemed was necessary to continue to, quote, reduce tensions, end quote, and carry out peace talks. Vice President Lyndon B. Johnson disagreed with this move, calling it a major, quote, political mistake, end quote. Sergei Khrushchev, Nikita's son, claimed that if Kennedy and his father had six more years together, the Cold War would have come to an end. But obviously, with the assassination of Kennedy, that would not be the outcome. Khrushchev had gotten Castro to begin to trust Kennedy, and things were moving in a positive direction for once. Without JFK's assassination, it could be argued that a normalized relationship with Cuba could have been achieved. With the Cold War ended, however, there would not have been a need for such a large national security state. The Pentagon and the CIA budgets would have been reduced, and those in unelected power would not have a stronghold over foreign decisions. Remember, war makes money. So was Kennedy's death planned because these people would be out of jobs? Their interests severed? It's something to consider going forward. Like I said, we were going to quickly talk about Berlin and the Cuban Missile Crisis, two big events during the Cold War. The main idea there was to highlight for you, again, this unelected power turning on President Kennedy and not liking his decisions. Our main topic today is going to be Kennedy's relationship with Israel and the Middle East in general. Now, before I start this section, I don't want to come off biased. I don't want to come off anti-Semitic, but I'm just stating facts from the past. I understand that right now, things are very sensitive between the Jewish community and the Palestinian community. But a lot of what we're going to talk about today is Israel's relationship with the Middle East back during Kennedy's presidency. So I want to make it clear, I'm not talking anything about bias or picking a side here. I'm simply stating facts and looking at who could be the actors behind Kennedy's assassination if it wasn't just such a simple murder. With all the distractions and conflicts with the Soviet Union during Kennedy's presidency, one major area of foreign policy is swept under the rug. This complicated relationship was that between the United States and Israel. Now, there were four major points of contention that Kennedy was dealing with when it came to Israeli relations. The first, Palestinian refugees. The second, his relations with Arab countries. The third, the American Zionist Council, a lobbying group in the United States. And fourth, the Israeli nuclear program. We're going to talk about each of these four areas in depth here and kind of get a gauge for what's going on with Israel at the time. As Israel was established and recognized by the United States after the Palestinian War in 1948, many Palestinians became homeless and stateless. Kennedy had put a large amount of effort into supporting the UN resolution, which would allow Palestinians to return to their homes and live in peace with their Israeli neighbors. Also, those who could not return home due to loss of property or damages should be fairly compensated by Israel or any other governments holding responsibility. Kennedy acknowledged the situation was not an easy one, but there had to be something done to restore peace in the region. Kennedy had devised a plan in which Palestinians would be given a choice whether to repatriate or to take compensation with Israel's approval. However, after receiving missiles for defense from the United States, Israel ended up backing out of Kennedy's deal and stopped cooperating with the ongoing peace talks and the refugee issue. The Prime Minister of Israel, Levi Eshkol, was upset that the United States was so keen on supporting the Arab nations. The Prime Minister made these remarks just 2 days before Kennedy's assassination. So what was the Prime Minister so upset with? What was Kennedy's administration doing that was such a threat to Israel's security? The big problem Israel had was the close relationship that JFK had built with Egypt's president, Gamal Abdel Nasser. Kennedy was sending aid to Egypt and supported them being the lead country in bringing the Middle East into the modern world. Israel was also upset that Kennedy would not make them, quote, exclusive friends, end quote, in the Middle East and supported their enemies, like Egypt. Egypt was also an ally of the Palestinian people and supported them after the Palestinian War. There was no one in the American government who knew as much or even cared as much, like JFK did, about the Middle East. One White House aide even said that Arab leaders who visited the White House were impressed with how much Kennedy knew about their country, and even he knew more than they did sometimes. But there were many politicians in D.C. who were tired of Kennedy's support of Arab nations, and such an amendment was put forward to stop it. Domestic attacks against Kennedy's support for Arab nations began to ramp up, and legislation was even put forward to address Kennedy's actions. The Gruning Amendment, set into motion by Senator Ernest Gruning in November of 1963, was meant to deny economic aid to any country that was preparing for aggression or was engaged in conflict with another country that the U.S. was already sending aid to, for example, Israel. This was almost a direct attack against Kennedy's Egypt funding, and many believe this amendment was aimed at preserving Israel's interests, not the American people. Kennedy was very unhappy with the amendment. He spoke publicly about the amount of spending the government did on defense and nuclear programs, but the president trying to build relationships with Arab nations was apparently going too far and being denied by the U.S. Congress. To him, this was nonsense. Kennedy even pointed out that the aid being sent was a fraction of the federal budget. After Kennedy's assassination later that month, LBJ stopped sending aid to Arab nations, something Israel would be extremely happy about. The third major issue Kennedy would have was with the American Zionist Council, acting as a foreign agent for Israel. This mostly occurred through the Justice Department with his brother Bobby Kennedy, the Attorney General. Now, this is an important piece because the American Zionist Council is where things get a little weird. The Justice Department wanted the American Zionist Council to register under the Foreign Agents Act of 1938. The direct explanation of this act from the Justice Department itself requires, quote, agents of foreign principals who are engaged in political activities or other activities specified under the statute to make periodic public disclosures of their relationship with the foreign principal, in this case Israel, as well as activities, receipts, and disbursements in support of activities. Disclosure of the required information facilitates evaluation by the government and the American people of the activities of such persons in light of their function as foreign agents. End quote. Now, I know that was really wordy, but let's put this simply. Basically, if you're acting as a foreign agent for another country, you need to show your books. During the 1960 presidential campaign, Kennedy was approached by Zionist financier Abraham Feinberg. Feinberg was offering to boost the Kennedy campaign in exchange for influence over his Middle East policy, mostly for Israel. Kennedy remarked that he would, quote, do something about it, end quote, if he won the presidency. Kennedy knew that the reason that Truman recognized Israel as a country so quickly in 1946 was because his re-election campaign received $2 million from the Zionists. Zionist lobbyists were supporting presidents to control their Middle East foreign policy, and Kennedy wasn't going to accept that anymore. During a press conference, Kennedy made his stance on, quote, buying, end quote, a candidate known. He stated, quote, while we're glad to have support, no one should contribute to any campaign fund under the expectation that it will do them the slightest bit of good, end quote. Kennedy wanted the support of his vision and character, but not to be bribed by interest groups. On November 21, 1962, the American Zionist Council was asked by the DOJ and Robert Kennedy to officially register as a foreign agent. In early December, the president of the AZC, which we'll call the American Zionist Council from now on, Rabbi Irving Miller, asked the DOJ for a four-month delay in the registration process. They claimed that, quote, the request for registration raised many questions of fact and of relationships which first must be resolved by us before compliance can be made, end quote. To me, the first question I ask is why? What are you hiding? Then, on January 2, 1963, just about a month after the request by the American Zionist Council for 120 days for delay, a man named Isaiah Kennan incorporated the American Israel Public Affairs Committee, which is still around today and is known as AIPAC, or IPAC. Kennan was formerly a part of the American Zionist Council running their public affairs branch, which was the lobbying division, renamed AIPAC, in 1958, and then incorporated it in 1963. Kennan did not register AIPAC as a foreign agent of the Israeli government with the DOJ either. During the court proceedings, a May 2, 1963 memo by the attorney representing the AZC claimed that the Jewish people were questioning how the Kennedy administration could harm the Zionist movement and impede the work of the American Zionist Council by insisting on registration. The DOJ ignored these victimizing claims that the government was acting against the Jewish community and forcing the movement to make their records public. The issue eventually made it to the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, which was led by Senator William Fulbright, who was actually Kennedy's original choice for Secretary of State, but Kennedy felt pressured by the Jewish community to replace his choice. Fulbright had supported an anti-Nasser policy, and the Jewish community was worried about the support for the Egyptian president. To not form a side of bias against the Jewish community in this situation, it needs to also be said that Robert Kennedy also advised his brother to not appoint Fulbright. On October 11, 1963, just over a month before JFK's assassination, the DOJ sent their official request for registration to the American Zionist Council with a 72-hour window to respond. In response, Judge Rifkind, their representative, stated that, quote, most persons affiliated with the council believed such registration would be so publicized by the American Council on Judaism, who opposed Zionism, that it would destroy the Zionist movement completely, end quote. Judge Rifkind believed that the AZC would at least supply the DOJ with the average documents that other registrants would submit, but nothing showing they were an agent of a foreign principal, Israel. The Department of Justice would not make a decision without seeing the filed material. The AZC did not file anything until after JFK's assassination. Memos between the DOJ and AZC went back and forth for about a year and a half until the DOJ called out the AZC saying they were blatantly stalling. The AZC would disband over time and never register as a foreign agent. They did, however, supply some financial paperwork to the DOJ in 1965, which satisfied the acting attorney general, Nicholas Katzenbach, and the case, it was closed. The replacement of the AZC, the AIPAC, has still never registered as a foreign agent to Israel. The argument here is that the AIPAC has significant influence on American policy today. William Fulbright stated in 1973 that, quote, Israel controls the U.S. Senate, end quote, and around 80% of the U.S. Senate supports Israel. Anything Israel wants, it gets. The final issue that Kennedy faced with Israel was their nuclear program, also called Dimona. Kennedy wanted thorough inspections of the facility, but after a meeting with Golda Meir, Meir assured him that the countries would have no problems between them dealing with the nuclear reactor. The new head of the CIA, John McCone, I know it sounds like John McCain, but it's John McCone, who Kennedy replaced Alan Dulles with, claimed that Israel could have limited nuclear capability by 1967 or 1968. McCone was very outspoken about Israel's nuclear program and actually publicized the Dimona back in 1960. In a memo sent to McCone, Chairman of the Board of Nuclear Assessments, Sherman Kent, stated that Israel would use its nuclear program and facilities to, quote, psychologically intimidate, end quote, its Arab neighbors. The fear was that this Arab resentment would fall on the U.S. for not keeping Israel in line. Kennedy sent a clear message to Israeli Prime Minister Ben-Gurion, informing him that the United States would be seeking semi-annual visits to Dimona and inspected by U.S. scientists. Kennedy was assured by Israel's Deputy Minister of Defense, Shimon Peres, that Israel would, quote, not introduce nuclear weapons in the Middle East and certainly wouldn't be the first, end quote. Kennedy was outraged that the Israelis kept lying about their nuclear capabilities right to his face. McCone claimed that Dimona would be at critical capacity by late 1963 or early 1964, and an inspection of the reactor would be critical before it was at full power. When Levi Eshkol became prime minister and replaced Ben-Gurion, he agreed to allow Kennedy's administration to visit Dimona, quote, toward the end of 1963, end quote. After Kennedy's assassination, LBJ, quote, saw no Dimona, heard no Dimona, and spoke no Dimona after it went critical in 1964, end quote. John McCone would leave the CIA after he could never get LBJ to read any of his reports about Dimona. When Ben-Gurion resigned his post as prime minister, this allowed a six-month delay in nuclear inspections. Kennedy would be dead by then. It is also known that a CIA agent named James Angleton knew that enriched uranium was being funneled to Israel from the Nuclear Materials and Equipment Corporation based in Pennsylvania. Two major things about Angleton. He was the head of counterintelligence in the CIA, as well as the head of its Israel desk. The real kicker about Angleton is his relationship with resigned Prime Minister Ben-Gurion. After Ben-Gurion's resignation, Angleton would meet with him at his private home to discuss, quote, business, end quote. But wait, there's more. In 1959, Angleton was a CIA agent who had all control over a CIA file. And that CIA file was all about one man named Lee Harvey Oswald. After Kennedy's assassination, Angleton was also the key CIA liaison to the Warren Commission. Now, if you are thinking back to what we have talked about in this series so far, we now have two CIA agents who are corrupt and working behind the president's back with some very powerful people. Even better, James Angleton and Alan Dulles were very close friends. When he was still prime minister, Ben-Gurion wrote a letter to Kennedy to warn him about the dangers of the Middle East regimes turning into the likes of the Nazis. He even compared the Egyptian president to Hitler. But the most eerie part of this letter was his disregard to answer Kennedy's request for nuclear inspections. What he wrote about instead was the concern of a potential assassination of the Jordanian king, Hussein. He stated, quote, "The Jordanian king has survived a number of attempts of assassination, but there is always a danger that one single bullet might put an end to his life and regime," end quote. Just 6 short months after this letter, it would take a single bullet to end Kennedy's life, his presidency, and change the future of the United States. Now, was this a preemptive warning or a threat? What exactly was this business that Ben-Gurion and James Angleton were discussing in their private meetings? What are the secrets that could be hidden in the United States' clandestine relationship with Israel? You're going to want to come back next week because we are going to dig our hands deep in the dirt and start to put together all these puzzle pieces that we've laid out in the first 4 parts of this series. Next week, we're going to talk about Kennedy's assassination and the players that could be involved. We'll also talk about some existing theories, as well as my personal theory, after research and reading plenty of material as to what I believe might be the real truth behind the JFK assassination. Thank you all again for listening to the History on the Rocks podcast. I hope you guys enjoyed this episode, and I hope you do come back next week because I'm telling you guys, it is getting real good. We are going to, like I said, put all this stuff together, hopefully make some sense out of everything that we've been talking about for the last 4 weeks. And I really hope you are enjoying the series still because I am enjoying researching it. People at work could tell you that I am pretty much obsessing over things that I am finding, and I'm on Google Maps and I'm looking at all this material and listening and reading all this material and bringing it all in. And I don't know. I love the investigative process of, you know, these types of theories and historical moments. So, but it's the weekend. So, whew, got all that out of the way. Hope you go see some friends, some family. Go relax. Enjoy your weekend. The warmer weather is starting to come. It's almost here. It was so nice the other day to walk outside in the sun and not freeze. And I can see the grass again. Y'all have a great weekend. Thank you again for listening to the History on the Rocks podcast. Cheers.